Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Frank Cogliano, who is still in California. How is California treating you?
It's fabulous, David. Thank you very much. It's morning here in California.
It's late afternoon here. We're dealing with a 7-hour, 8-hour time difference, but that's the way the world works, I guess. Any business before we get started, Frank?
No, I don't think so. I think we're ready to go.
All right. So for your last drop last week, Frank, you talked about this article that dispelled this myth of Irish slaves, which is going to inspire our first segment, which is about myths in American history and particularly about myths that are dangerous, myths that have been sort of pervasive and influential in shaping ways in which Americans think about their past and think about their present. And so what Frank and I have done, we've each come up with a top three for each of us of myths that we think are particularly dangerous or insidious. So Frank, what's your number three?
My number three, we're counting backwards.
We're going to count down. It's like, you got to go up to the number one, like Casey Kasem,
right, okay,
back in the day.
Number three on the most insidious myths in America. I would say one that strikes me, particularly from my own field of early American history, that's very, very persistent, would be the myth of a religious foundation for America. Now, like most myths, this has a kernel of truth to it. I mean, we do know that the Pilgrim Separatists went to Plymouth in modern Massachusetts in 1620, and that they were seeking kind of religious separatism. We know they were followed by the Puritans a decade later. However, this has been kind of become a myth, kind of belief that the foundations of America or the American colonies and later United States implicitly were inherently religious. And this goes to the notion that there was a Christian founding of the United States. And while, as I said, there's a kernel of truth to it, it's not that simple. So, for example, we also know that the people who settled in Virginia and Maryland were not terribly religious in the 17th century and were coming seeking money. And in many respects, they are the earliest proponents of what we might call the American dream, which I think you're going to talk about later. So I think that this myth of a religious founding is insidious because of the hold it has on that it has on contemporary politics and the way it's been manipulated in the three centuries since. So that would be probably my, I guess I would have that as my, I don't know, that's my first or third most insidious myth.
I mean, it's sort of a follow-up to that. There's all this stuff about sort of the founding, the religious founding, thinking about the revolutionary generation being religious in their inspiration. And I think there's a Christian conservative interpretation of American history that makes them into fundamentalist Christians as well, which I think is not based very much in the historical evidence.
Well, that's right. I mean, you can draw a line from the kind of from the Pilgrims and Puritans in Massachusetts in the 1620s and 30s to this supposed Christian founding of the American Republic. And you're absolutely right, David. And that is a very, very persistent and prevalent view in certain quarters within American life today, particularly on the right wing of the homeschooling movement, for example. Well, and it's really, really problematic, frankly. It's just it's inaccurate.
I believe the state standards in Texas, which is obviously one of the largest states and a state that has tremendous influence in textbooks and other things, the state standards there say that the American Revolution was and the leaders of the revolution were devoutly religious, which just other than maybe Patrick Henry, I don't think is really true. All right, my number three I think is the myth of black criminality, which I think is a very I think like yours a very long standing myth, and it's one that has very deep roots going back into slavery. The slave owners talk about part of the reasons for justifying slavery was that African Americans were inherently criminal, and that slavery was an institution that controlled the barbarism, in their words, of African Americans. And it's a myth that continued after slavery. This myth of black criminality was vitally important in justifying lynchings in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It helped to justify segregated schools, the fears that African American men in particular were sexual predators was a very prominent part of that. That helped to justify, you know, many of the lynchings was the fear that black men would rape white women. And it's a myth, I think, that has not disappeared from the American landscape. You can see it, thinking about in a fairly recent times in the Central Park Five case, for instance, from the late 1980s, I think, part of the reason why those five black teenagers were presumed guilty was because of this sort of pervasive myth of black criminality. And some people may recall that Donald Trump put out a full-paged ad in the New York Times, I think, saying that they should be executed, despite the fact that the evidence against them turned out to be pretty flimsy. It turns out they weren't guilty of much of anything other than being in the wrong place at the wrong time. To be bipartisan about it, you can talk about, Hillary Clinton, talked about super predators, and there was very definitely sort of racially coded, undertones to that that harks back to this myth. And I think in some ways the sense of the myth of black criminality has more recently been mapped onto other people of color, thinking about people's suppositions about criminality of immigrants and Mexicans, but also people of Middle Eastern descent, and having the same supposition that skin color shapes, a predisposition to crime. I think that myth has been extraordinarily dangerous. All right, what's your number two, Frank?
I guess my number two would be a more specific. We've been talking about more kind of, if you will, big picture myths, although it speaks to something. It speaks to a larger trend, I think, which is, there's a long-standing myth that one encounters, particularly among students, but more generally, that President Roosevelt knew about the Pearl Harbor attacks in advance and allowed it to happen so that to get the United States into the Second World War. And this is a hardy perennial myth, I think. There's very little evidence to support it. The evidence suggests that Roosevelt was warned that there might be an attack on American interest in the Pacific, but it wasn't a specific warning about Pearl Harbor. Why I think this is interesting and, if you will, insidious, is because it speaks to a tendency to believe conspiracies. Yeah. So there are different conspiracies throughout American history, but the kind of power of conspiracy illustrated by this example is very, very strong and profound, and I think it distorts our understanding of the American past, but also warps our understanding of the present as well in ways that are quite problematic. So it's not just – I mean, that's one example. Another example would be the multiple conspiracies associated with the assassination of John Kennedy, or more recently 9/11, even the whole birtherism about President Obama associated with President Obama, particularly by Donald Trump, but also by others, is a product of this conspiratorial mindset. And many years ago, the great historian Richard Hofstadter wrote about the kind of paranoid style in American politics, and I think he was. That's a warning about this tendency in our understanding of American history and American politics, and it's persistent, and this tendency that we can kind of laugh off some of these conspiracies, but actually seeing in the aggregate the tendency to accept and believe conspiracies is quite pernicious.
Well, why is it? I mean, they seem to be sort of the perennial subject of History Channel shows and exposés, and it seems like Americans are more predisposed to this than people of other countries, that there is some kind of secret cabal running things, dark corners of the internet, you'll find all this kind of nonsense. well, it's been a long time since I've read Hofstadter. What do you think is the... Do you think it's more American than other places, or is this...
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd agree with that, David. I mean, I think that I think it is a tendency one can see in American culture, in aspects of American culture. But whether it's really unique to the United States or not, I'm not so sure about. One, you know, the kind of enthusiasm for conspiracies, if that's the right way to frame it, in Europe, especially associated with anti-Semitism, the Prodigals of the Elders of Zion, at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, right before the First World War, suggests that this is not necessarily uniquely American. Oh. And one only needs to look at witch hunting and persecution of witches across history, and which seems to be a transnational phenomena. I don't think we should be so exceptionalist as to castigate Americans for being particularly conspiratorially minded. But there is certainly this tendency in the way people approach American history. I think conspiracies are attractive to people because they give an explanation for things. We can't just say, that events happen in certain ways because of macro trends or what have you. Instead, you're able to have a kind of simple explanation, complex. Based on assumed complexity, but it's actually relatively simplistic, that there's some villain, super villain, that's kind of pulling the strings from behind. It's very interesting that Donald Trump traffics in conspiracies often, because I think it suits his kind of mindset. He doesn't necessarily appreciate the complexity of the world. Conspiracies are actually often quite simplistic, and they assume the worst intentions on the part of one's opponents most of the time as well, while also ascribing them sort of superpowers. It's a very interesting tendency.
Okay. So my number two is The Lost Cause. This is a myth that develops really right at the end of the Civil War that helps white Southerners explain why they lost the Civil War. And the term itself comes from a book written by Edward Pollard, right about a year after the war ends. And it really describes this very robust explanation, mythology about why the South lost. And I don't, we don't have time to sort of disentangle all of it, but part of it is, an explanation says the South lost in large part because the North had far more men and resources, and therefore we should understand the Southern loss not really as any sort of deficit in Southern manhood, any deficit in Southern leadership. They argue that Southern soldiers were better soldiers, Southern generals were better generals. They're simply subsumed by numbers and resources. And it attaches a certain sort of romance to the Confederacy and to the antebellum South. It attaches sort of a deification to figures like Stonewall Jackson, but especially to Robert E. Lee, who has become in the 150 years since the Civil War, a semi-divine figure. But there's two parts to the Lost Cause myth that I think are particularly pernicious and dangerous. Part of the Lost Cause myth says that the Civil War was not caused by slavery. And you can see this appearing in books written by Jefferson Davis after the war. Jefferson Davis, of course, the president of the Confederacy, and Alexander Stephens, the vice president of the Confederacy. They both write these books after the war that say that the war was not about slavery. The war was about states' rights, it was about the tariff, it was about these other factors. And they go on to say that the war would have happened had slavery not existed, or had slavery existed everywhere, that it was other issues that shaped why the war happened. The problem with that is it's explicitly a lie, that if you read the Ordinances of Secession, they state very explicitly over and over again that the reason why Southern states are seceding is because of slavery and because of the threat to slavery they see in the election of Abraham Lincoln. Alexander Stephens, who after the war says the war wasn't about slavery, says in 1861 that the cornerstone of the Confederacy is slavery and white supremacy. He says that is the basis that this new government is being built on. And so that's one part of the myth that I think is really pernicious and has very been very persistent over the past 150 years, is that this idea that the Civil War wasn't about slavery. The Civil War is about slavery. It was caused by slavery. It was caused by slavery in complicated ways, but slavery is the cause, period. The other part about the Lost Cause that's very pernicious is, you know, they say, look, the Civil War wasn't about slavery, but on the same side time they say slaves were happy being slaves, that the antebellum South was this in some ways perfect society that the war destroyed, and that, you know, it was Northern hostility to slavery that destroyed what was essentially a benevolent institution. It's also been an extraordinarily pervasive myth, when in fact all the scholarship on slavery shows us, and you don't even need to look at the scholarship, you can look at the words of the slaves themselves, that slavery was an extraordinarily brutal institution, that slaves hated being slaves and resisted their enslavement in all manner of ways. Part of the reason why this myth has been so persistent, I think, has to do with the media. Probably the two big films on the Civil War era from the first half of the 20th century, Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind, and also the books that preceded them by Thomas Dixon and Mitchell, are essentially manifestations of this Lost Cause narrative, saying that the South was this perfect society before the war, the Confederacy was its apex, but then the North, you know, destroyed this ideal society. And what's remarkable about the Lost Cause to me is the extent to which the Lost Cause not only persuaded Southerners about what happened in the war, but also persuaded people around the world, really, that the South and the Confederacy was, you know, worthy of admiration. You can see this in sort of the pervasiveness of, you know, Confederate flags. I've seen Confederate flags flying in California and in North Dakota, and I saw a Confederate flag on a bumper sticker of a car the first year I was here in Edinburgh, and I almost chased
there
it down.
There is occasionally there's occasionally one flying from a house on the M8 between Edinburgh and Glasgow. You see it if you drive by on the M8 occasionally.
I'm hoping they're just Dukes of Hazzard fans or something, because but I think that speaks to how powerful this myth is, that it's able to, you know, permeate the culture. You know, if you ask people who the greatest, you know, if you ask sort of non-historians who the best Civil War general was, they almost always say Robert E. Lee. And in part of that, I think, is because, you know, how powerful this myth has been in glorifying him, and, you know, at the same time sort of denigrating people like Grant and Sherman as being butchers, which I think is, you know, a distortion of all those figures.
Right. No, I agree with you completely. That's a very, very potent and powerful myth and kind of set of ideas that it encapsulates.
So I think we actually both had the same number one. Am I right?
I think we did. I think we did. So I'll... we both talked about the we came up with these lists separately, but we both agreed on the American Dream as being number one.
Yeah.
Now, as I said with at the outset, many myths are powerful because they have a kernel of truth to them, and the belief in the United States as a land of opportunity is incredibly potent. In fact, that's a better founding myth than the myth of a religious founding.
Mm.
To go back to my third myth, if you will. However, it's also been proven that, for example, in the contemporary world, there's greater social mobility in places like Canada and Western Europe at the moment than there is in the United States. So there's the power of the myth of the American Dream is very, very strong. It's a very potent myth. I'll let you have your say, but I think it actually distorts our understanding of of American history, and more importantly, it has a very powerful and corrosive effect on policy in the United States, yeah. For example. The reason people rail against inheritance taxes, everybody believes they're going to die a millionaire.
Exactly. No, I think you're 100%, you know, there's this myth, I think, that the United States is a classless society, which is nonsense. You know, there's also, I think some of this is rooted in, you know, your era, you know, in the revolution, that the United States is rejecting the class society, the rigid class-based society of Europe in favor of a more flexible kind of system. There's the sort of late 19th century version of this in the Horatio Alger novels, which invariably have, you know, a poor, you know, orphan child who works very hard and somehow gets lucky and saves a rich person's kid from drowning or something, and then gets a job in the factory and works his way up and ends up becoming a millionaire. This idea that, you know, upward mobility is anybody but can become president, I think is, you know, there's an element of truth to that. At some point you can see individuals, you can make claims, you can look, here's a person, you know, you're Andrew Carnegie, who's able to work himself up from nothing to, you know, becoming extraordinarily wealthy. But I think you're right. It's been dangerous in as much as helps to explain why, you know, the social safety net in the United States isn't very robust. It helps to, you know, that the idea that, well, if people are poor, it's because they're not working hard enough. If you're working hard enough, you should be able to make it in America. And I think that ignores all the kinds of structural ways in which, you know, poverty reinscribes itself and wealth reinscribes itself. That there isn't as much social mobility as Americans would like to think there is.
The two books that struck me in thinking about this, David, are the recent bestseller, Hillbilly Elegy, yeah. Which has gone, you know, shot to the top of the bestseller list as people sought to understand Trump and Trumpism. And I think there's a lot to that book. It's a personal memoir of somebody from a kind of deprived rural background, a white background, who himself goes on to Yale and so on and so forth. So he seems to embody the American dream, but kind of explains the culture from which he came and how difficult it is. And it's a real indictment, if you will, of the American dream. And the other one is George Packer's book, The Unwinding, which came out now about 2009, 2010, but which presaged a lot of these tendencies and looked at the declining opportunity and decline of social mobility in the 21st century. And I think one of the phenomena that's happening, one of the things that helps explain the rise of Donald Trump, and I think Trump might be the symptom rather than the disease in this case, is the fact that for many white Americans, they're coming up against the limits of social mobility, possibly for the first time in memory. If one goes back 60 or 70 years in the aftermath of the Second World War, a white working class person could enjoy a very high standard of living in the United States and could reasonably expect that their children would have greater opportunities than they had. So the American dream was quite potent for that white majority, say, in the 1950s. Yeah. It's a very different picture, of course, for African Americans in that time when the United States had apartheid. Okay. I don't think they see that as a golden age, and nor should they. But I think for the white working class population in the United States, opportunities have declined over the past 60 or 70 years, and that in part has been what helps explain recent political developments. It's also a reflection of the fact that they are Americans of European descent, white Americans, if you will, are set to become the largest minority in the United States within a couple of decades. So there's a kind of cultural anxiety about that, as well as this economic anxiety. But all of this suggests that when set beside the belief that social mobility is the norm, and that it's ever onwards and upwards because of the American dream, that people are especially frustrated. It's the reason why we have a Democratic Party in the United States, but not a Labour Party.
Exactly.
The Labour Party, such as we have in the UK, is premised on a belief that there is a working class that has inherent interests, and the party represents and promotes those interests. The Democratic Party, which is the equivalent in the United States, encompasses labor and the labor movement, but it is not a labor party per se.
Yeah, and the fact that the socialist, parties in the United States have never really caught on the way that they have in Europe and been sort of institutionalized, and the ways in which socialism, by its nature, has always had been a dirty word in American politics, in a way that it hasn't, I think, in a European context. That's part of that. And it always strikes me that, one of the things that baffles me about America is how many Americans, thinking about the American dream, define themselves as middle class.
Yes.
That somebody who was making $20,000 a year thinks they're middle class, and somebody who's making $200,000 a year also thinks they're middle class. And if those two people are both in the same, thinking of themselves as belonging to the same part of society, then somebody's deluding themselves, or everybody's deluding themselves. And I think there's a much broader spectrum that sort of falls into that kind of conception of class mobility and class identity than I think in countries that have a different history about the relationship with class and about social mobility.
Yes, I mean, I think a corollary of the American dream is, of course, a belief that somehow the United States is a classless society, and it's obviously just not true. But there's Americans tend to be uncomfortable with the language of class, particularly because of its Marxist overtones. We, and I say we because we're both Americans in this case, are much more comfortable talking about race, or at least saying that we want to talk about race. Whether we actually want to talk about race is a whole other discussion. Yeah. But we're much more comfortable saying talking about race than we are talking about class. And I think in part that's a legacy of the Cold War and just skepticism about Marxism and the language of class.
All right. For our second segment, we've got a question from a listener. Frank, this is actually somebody Alan in Edinburgh. You want to read the question?
Sure. My friend Alan writes and said, when does the word Democrat become central to American discourse? When did the Republic first start to think of itself as a democracy? What did the founders have to say about ideas of democracy? How had interpretations of the term changed over the generations? It's a really good question and a really interesting question. And thank you, Alan. I think it's interesting because, for a number of reasons. First of all, we now take democracy for granted and assume it's a good thing.
Yeah.
That was not always the case in the history of the United States, as Alan's question implies. Certainly during the 18th century, the period of my own research expertise, democracy was a bad word. Mm. I mean, democracy was assumed to be kind of a code word for anarchy.
And
a distinction was made between the men, and they were men who kind of framed the American Republic between republics, which were good, and democracies, which were bad. And the assumption was that democracy was mob rule, and that democracy needed to be limited in the 18th century. Mm. And so what they were seeking to do was to strike a balance between monarchy, and which was rule of one, and democracy, which is mob rule, and they fastened onto a republic, which was a polity where the people exercise their sovereignty through the vote, but then they step aside and let their betters govern, essentially.
And
go ahead.
Well, I think a large part of their aversion to democracy, both as a concept and as a word, is probably tied to their familiarity with the classics. The founding generation, even if they hadn't read Aristotle, they read people who had read Aristotle. And, Aristotle talks about democracy as being one of the worst forms of government as a form of, mob rule. And, I think they are latching on to these sort of, the classical models, the reason why they pick the word republic, and they use some of the structures like the Senate and use this language is because they you know, are basing this conception of what good government is on the Roman Republic in particular, and this idea of a mixed constitution that, you know, people like Plato talk about.
That's right. That's absolutely right. So they're grounded in the kind of in classical approaches, and they've learned from the 17th and 18th century Whig tradition in Britain, which they've inherited and imbibed. And in fact, they interpret the classics often through that lens. But they have a very different understanding. They use that we use the same language of republics and democracies that they used in the 18th century, but they use it in a very different way. But this all changed, so now we have a different understanding of democracy. And I think your century, David, the 19th century, is the crucial transition. Particularly, we've talked about him already on this podcast. Andrew Jackson and the Age of Jackson is when the kind of language of democracy and a more modern sense of what we think a democracy to be in the United States emerges. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the things that happens between, you know, the Revolution and about 1830 is there's a shift in thinking about who should be part of the Republic, who should be eligible to vote. You've got people like John Adams, you know, who are very dismissive of the idea that poor people should be able to vote. And you know, I think there's debate among the revolutionary generation about how far to expand, you know, suffrage, who should be part of the governing of the state. You know, should it be limited just to both voting and office holding? Should it be limited simply to the elite? Should it be expanded? And how far it should be expanded? And you can see you know, different states in the aftermath of the revolution expanding the suffrage slightly. And that picks up steam, I think, you know, in the early decades of the 19th century, sort of culminating in this era that we call the era, some people call the era of Jacksonian democracy, in which the suffrage, the right to vote is expanded basically to all white men. And, you know, the idea therefore is that not only do, you know, poor people have a right to vote, but they actually have a, you know, as much of a right, as much of an entitlement to civic engagement as people who may have more wealth and property. And there's a celebration, I think, in the Jacksonian era of the common man, of the, you know, the person who may not have property but still has involvement in the Republic, and celebrating them as being part of a democracy. And you see that being reinforced, I think, you know, during the Civil War era, when obviously, you know, millions of men go off to fight, the recognition that you know, it's about participation in the state, shouldn't be constrained to, you know, the limited few, like, you know, some of the founders thought it should be. And I think if you go into the 20th century, I think you find that trend being sort of expanded, the idea that, you know, the right to vote is a sort of default category once you've got women voting, once you have things like the Voting Rights Act in 1965. You know, the past 50 years, the assumption is that all people who are adults and not felons, and there's a, maybe we can get off on that story on a different episode, you know, that suffrage is universal. I think that actually ties in. You know, I think many of the revolutionary generation be horrified at the current state of voting rights, in part because they would see this as being more democratic, whereas I think obviously today we take the word democracy as being an unalloyed good. There is a question, I think, you know, thinking about recent politics, about how democratic our system is. You know, lots of politicians celebrate democracy, but we're stuck with lots of political structures which I think are, you know, not very democratic. The Electoral College, for instance, is supremely undemocratic. The ways in which gerrymandering have you know, shaped voting rights is also, you know, fundamentally anti-democratic in as much as lots of voters don't really get much of a meaningful say in who their representatives are.
Yes, I mean, two things strike me, David, when I was listening to your comments. One is that it's very interesting that we are using the language the language of our democracy in the United States is very much premised on the language of the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah.
And the assertion that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the mission statement for the United States. And it's very eloquent and very powerful. And it's very interesting that this 18th century statement, derived from Locke and the Scottish Enlightenment, has been used as a kind of wedge to make the country more democratic.
Mm-hmm.
So we've held that up as our kind of, as I said, mission statement. And through much of our history, reformers and very well-intentioned reformers have pointed to that and said, yeah, but it doesn't include the following groups, and we need to include those groups. And that's, or members of those groups have made that assertion. And that's been incredibly powerful, but there's a kind of deep irony at the heart of this American democracy that it's premised on this 18th century statement from a person, Thomas Jefferson, who himself would not necessarily recognize what we call democracy today. So that's the first one. The other thing that struck me while you were speaking is that we seem to have moved away from that, or we seem to be moving away from that assertion of democracy as an unalloyed good. We have done in the more recent past. One only has to look at the attempts to restrict voting rights that we've seen in the past couple of electoral cycles.
Yeah.
So there's an assumption that that maybe too much democracy, at least on the part of some people, that too much democracy might be a bad thing. Yet we've retained this rhetoric.
Yeah.
Of valorizing democracy above all. So I thought about that this week when during the hearings over Neil Gorsuch for the Supreme Court, and I heard Senator Ted Cruz from Texas say that Gorsuch will have a super mandate because the his nomination is a result of the election of Donald Trump. Now, the obstruction of President Obama's last nominee for the Supreme Court, Merrick Garland, was incredibly undemocratic on the part of Republicans in the Senate. The outcome of the election in November, as you alluded to via the Electoral College, certainly is not democratic in the sense that 3 million more people voted for Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump. Yet Senator Cruz turned this around to somehow claim a kind of democratic legitimacy for Neil Gorsuch. Now, I think this is absurd. But what's interesting to me is that he felt the need to do so.
Yeah. Well, it strikes me that, you know, just thinking about you're talking about the restrictions on voting that have been coming into place in a number of states in the past half decade, you know, a lot of the, even though we can see those as being efforts to shrink the size of the voting pool and make it harder for people to vote and all these things, the language they use, and I think you're right about the rhetoric, the language they use is that they say, look, we are defending democracy by ridding it of corruption. Or they're saying that they make this argument about fraudulent voters, which is nonsense. There's no evidence for that on any meaningful scale. Yeah. There's no meaningful voter fraud today. But they say, look, we are protecting democracy by making it harder to vote or by requiring ID or whatever it is that they're doing. To undermine democracy fundamentally, but using democracy as defense.
That's right. So, David, we can trace a kind of trajectory in answer to Alan's question that democracy was a kind of bad word in the first 50 years of the Republic, and it gradually becomes something good. It becomes a virtue, and that remains our kind of rhetorical. It remains the kind of basis of the political system to this very day.
Yeah.
But we seem to be in a transitional moment. I mean, do you see democracy as being the at the heart of American politics, you know, 20 years from now?
You know, democracy is as I understand it, to, you know, where the will of the people is, you know, reflected by the government. I don't see a great deal of that in American politics today. I mean, obviously the structures of government are, you know, were created in a time when they're very much trying to protect government from the will of the people, you know, and the ways in which, you know, the senators were originally elected was to you know, make them insulated from the will of the people, the way in which, thinking about the Gorsuch nomination right now, the ways in which Supreme Court justices, you know, that's isolated from the will of the people. There's lots of ways in which the structures of government that we've inherited are anti-democratic. And the things that we've layered on top of it, thinking about the Citizens United decision, the ways in which, you know, money in politics is more powerful than voting in politics sometimes. It doesn't seem like a particularly democratic system to me, and I don't see any great hope for it in the future, although I'm, you know, I'm hoping I'm wrong about becoming more democratic, you know, in, at least in the immediate future.
Well, hold on. Let me give returning to last week and notes of optimism. I mean, remember, this sometimes is cyclical. So I think the present moment in many respects with its extremes of wealth and poverty and the limitations on political rights and things like that is remarkably like the 1890s. Mm. And that was followed by a period of reform. So we may – don't give up hope yet, David or listeners. You know, we could be on the verge of a new progressive era.
I have mixed feelings about the progressive, so a new progressive era might, but a new and improved and better progressive era maybe. Okay. So it's time for last drops. Frank, what do you got?
Well, one of the myths which we didn't really discuss, and we left it aside deliberately was because of my last drop, concerns Native Americans and indigenous peoples in America. And one of the really insidious myths in America is that somehow they're not still among us. We've seen with the recent protests over the pipeline in North Dakota that is not the case. And there was a wonderful essay this week in The Atlantic by Gregory Smithers. And Greg's is a historian at Virginia Commonwealth University. He used to be at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. No. And Greg wrote about the Pocahontas myth and the power of Pocahontas over four centuries. And it's a wonderful essay, and Greg's an expert on Native American history. And in that essay, he looks at the kind of evolution of the myth of Pocahontas, the Powhatan princess, supposedly, who allegedly saved Captain John Smith. This is the founding myth for the colony and state of Virginia, and of course America more generally.
And the inspiration for the Disney movie.
And the inspiration for the Disney movie, among others. And and Greg unpacks this in a very brief but powerful essay. And one of the interesting things about the essay, and we can link to it, is that he draws a contrast between the way Pocahontas is being treated and analyzed in contemporary American discourse and the fact that we're approaching the 400th anniversary of her death. She died in Gravesend in England, in Kent, in 1617. And that the commemorations in England are very, very much of the more traditional view that she's a kind of seen as a kind of heroic, tragic figure who sought to unite two cultures and so on. Whereas in contemporary discourse in the United States, particularly among Native peoples, it's a much more complicated legacy. Anyway, I commend that essay to you. It's actually a wonderful essay. What's your and it appeared in The Atlantic this week. David, what is your last drop?
All right, so last week I went with one of my sons to go see the new X-Men Wolverine movie, Logan, and which is an okay movie. I'm not really endorsed the movie. It was fine. It wasn't, you know, it's probably sort of in the middling of the X-Men movies. But one of the central plot points of the movie is that one of the characters wants to get to the great state of North Dakota. In fact, I think North Dakota got mentioned more in that movie than in pretty much anything else besides maybe Fargo. Unfortunately, when they actually got to the part that was supposed to be North Dakota, it didn't actually look like North Dakota, partially because it was filmed in New Mexico, not in North Dakota. And I bring all this up because, as some listeners may know, I am a former resident of the great state of North Dakota. And I was looking at some of the data from people who have downloaded our show, Podbean Laws, just to give some sense of where our show is being listened to. And we have lots of listeners in the UK. But for the US, it actually breaks it down by state. And the top states are Virginia, which I'm imagining is a lot of your doing, Frank. California, New York, all this is not all that surprising. But the fourth most popular state to download our show is the state of North Dakota, which, considering the population of North Dakota is less than 1 million people, I think that's actually quite impressive. And I'm imagining most of these people who are downloading our show in North Dakota are either my former students or former colleagues. So I wanted to endorse the great state of North Dakota and people who are listening to the show there. Frank, you ever been to North Dakota?
I have never been to North Dakota, David. I confess. We should go on the road and do a live broadcast from North Dakota.
You know, there are lots of people who have told me, you know, when I mentioned that I've lived in North Dakota, that's like the one state they haven't been to. There's a lot to recommend in North Dakota. There's some great curling there. If you like to go curling, there's some great cross-country skiing. Western part of North Dakota, which unfortunately is now littered with oil rigs of various kinds, can be very, very beautiful. Teddy Roosevelt National Park is probably the least visited national park, I think, in the country, at least in the lower 48. But it's really, really quite beautiful. Lots of bison, if you're interested in seeing bison and interesting land formations, other kinds of things. So, great state, North Dakota.
Excellent.
All right. Until next time, Frank, cheers.